From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. As newspapers financially struggle and mass layoffs have become the norm, a Bay Area legislator wants the state to help. Assemblyman Mark Levine is looking at state tax relief for papers and bans on layoffs. But does a state government intervention compromise journalistic independence? We'll debate it right after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. As Hetty just mentioned, we will, coming up in our second hour, talk with reporter Sharon McNary, who's there at that news conference with State Attorney General Javier Becerra, to get more of the details of the deal reached between L.A. City and County with SoCal Gas, which operated the huge storage field at Porter Ranch, where natural gas is stored. Coming up a little bit later, L.A. Metro CEO Phil Washington will be with us. We'll talk about the latest in public transit. We'll look at the project to speed up the Orange Bus Line through the valley and find out whether it'll back up street crossings as a result. Also, Metro's code of conduct, is it being enforced? Or is Metro too concerned about bad publicity to remove offenders? First, a Bay Area legislator is considering ways the state could help financially ailing newspapers and lay off vulnerable journalists. But if the state does provide tax or other relief, does it risk newspapers becoming leery of deeper reporting on government? With us is Democratic Assemblyman from Marin County, Mark Levine. Good morning, Assemblyman. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks so much. Glad to join you.
Well, we've talked a lot on this program about the crisis in newspapers, mass layoffs, the financial problems that print journalism has faced over the years. What are some of the things you're considering where the state might ease that financial burden?
Well, I'm concerned about a couple things. First of all, hedge funds have gone in and purchased newspapers, and they've squeezed profits out of them. They're actually making money, but they're laying off newsroom staff to do so. We need to put an end to that. And, you know, of course, the newspaper publishers will probably oppose such a thing, but there is something that we can also give. Back in the recession of the 1990s, Governor Wilson and the legislature decided to levy a sales tax on newspapers. So what I'm proposing at this early stage, and we're just at the early stage here, is not giving money to newspapers, but removing that sales tax. That will help relieve some of the pressure from the Trump tariffs on newsprint, which has increased costs by about 30%, and in exchange, freeze layoffs before the sale and purchase of a newspaper so that we can save those local news jobs that we depend upon to know what's going on in our communities. But I'm not looking to subsidize any of these papers with government money or public tax money, or having the hand of government in those newsrooms. We just want to remove barriers to people getting their news, some of which were put up over 20 years ago.
When I started working in public broadcasting back in the 1980s, there actually were state funds that were used for public broadcasting, a state version of the federal funds that come from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to public broadcast entities across the U.S. With one of the many financial crises that the state faced, they eliminated that funding for public broadcasting. So at this point, there are no state dollars that go to stations like KPCC or KQED up there in the communities that you serve, Assembly Member. Is it something that you think the legislature would ever consider funds going to nonprofit journalism, or would you be concerned about potential conflicts of interest in reporting then?
It's not a bad thing. The News Hour is my favorite news program that's broadcast on our public radio station in the Bay Area, KQED and others, and of course is on PBS. That's a great source of news. People should, of course, take many sources of news to figure out what's going on in the world. So it can be done, and the federal government has done it, and it's, you know, many Republicans oppose that. But that's not what I'm proposing here. But I'm open to many ideas to make sure that we have a democratic society, a civil society that is fully informed about what's going on. And if we can remove barriers for people to get the news and information they need and save the jobs to make sure that that reporting exists, then I'm for it. And I'm a public official. Not every news story is the news story that I want to have told or told the way that I would like it to be told. But nonetheless, it is just critical for a functioning democracy. And we've got to be on the side of a free press in an era where the president is saying that the press is the enemy. It is far from the truth.
Do you know how much money the state takes in from newspaper sales taxes currently, and how much revenue you'd be giving up if you forego that sales tax?
It's a rough estimate of about $10 million per year. And so it seems like a drop in the bucket for a state with $130 billion annual general fund. But it is real money. And I'd like to think that it's not the government's money. It's, of course, a tax that was put on in the 90s that maybe it's time for it to go. But you have to figure out, what do we not do with $10 million to remove that tax? And that's going to be difficult for the legislature to wrap its head around, and us to also talk with other stakeholders that see that it's a zero-sum game with tax dollars and $10 million in an era where perhaps this boom that we've had may be coming to an end, that we may not have extra money. One way to do that is to propose doing this so long as the Trump tariffs are in effect, or perhaps for a period that sunsets.
We're talking with Democratic Assemblymember Mark Levine of Marin and Southern Sonoma counties in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's looking at introducing a bill in the next legislative session which would provide some relief to particularly newspapers. As he mentioned, they've been hit by tariffs, so newsprint costs have gone up. Also, we're well aware of the kinds of financial stressors that newspapers have faced in recent years and with mass layoffs. One of the things that would be controversial would be a state ban on newspaper layoffs after there's an acquisition of a newspaper or chain of newspapers. How would that potentially affect the value of papers? Might it actually backfire and mean that it would be less likely struggling papers would be acquired by entities that could keep them going?
So what we've seen is that hedge funds have invested in local media, the LA Daily News, and others in Southern California, in Northern California, the San Jose Mercury News is an example of that. And the hedge funds have gone in. These are actually profitable enterprises, but have slashed journalist jobs to squeeze even greater profits out of it. The Denver Post is an example of one of those papers where, the newsroom and the editorial room was completely decimated in the name of profits by Alden, the hedge fund. And so it's not as though they're coming in to save a paper, unlike what has happened with the LA Times, where a local investor has come in and done that. We've seen that also with the Santa Rosa Press Democrat. A local investor has come in and have propped up a paper and have supported it and have found a way to make it profitable in a business model that is successful without slashing jobs to make even more money for shareholders. And so that's the model that we want. What's happened with the LA Times or the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, we don't need to have journalists, a generation of journalists and maybe future generations of journalists turned away in the name of profits by, hedge funds in Wall Street, looking to extract as much money, not out of struggling papers, but quite frankly, out of papers that have found a way to make a profit.
Assemblyman, thank you for joining us and talking about the ideas here. We understand it's still in the formative stage, but thanks for talking with us about some of the things you're considering. And again, you're looking at timeline for the next legislative session for introduction?
That's right. So, we're looking at affecting the next budget. So, we've already passed the budget in June for this fiscal year. We're looking at putting the package together that we can get the stakeholders, the Newspaper Publishers Association, the guilds that represent journalists, as well as people who care about a functioning democracy and civil society and the information we get, having some type of consensus on what that package looks like. And then we need to also make sure that the legislature and the future governor can agree on rescinding the sales tax on newspapers, and that's a different discussion that also has to take place. So it's a complicated issue.
All right.
And that I hope that we can resolve by next spring.
Assemblyman Levine, thank you for being with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Democratic Assemblyman Mark Levine of Marin and Southern Sonoma counties talking about his proposal. I'd like to hear your thoughts about this. The tax relief he's talking about, $10 million, very small compared to the size of California's budget, as he said, might be beneficial to particularly small papers who are paying sales tax. He also mentioned a freeze on layoffs when there are acquisitions of papers. We're at 866-893-KPECC, or you can comment on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us from the Poynter Institute, senior faculty member for broadcast and online journalism, Al Tompkins. Al, good to have you with us again. What do you think of this?
Well, I really appreciate where the Assemblyman's heart is on this. I think there are some real friction issues. One is, I don't know how you tell a business that they can't lay somebody off. If the business is purchased by another business, it seems to me it's their right to make those decisions unless there are contracts involved. Where the sales tax issue comes involved, there's quite a lot of history around sales tax and publications. You can, in your free time, Google the phrase English Stamp Act. It was something that the British passed around 1712 and imposed on the colonists in 1765, and basically it said you can't transact any piece of paper unless it has the British seal on it. And that applied to newspapers as well as legal documents and a number of other things. The colonists rebelled against the Stamp Act, as you will recall from your middle history, and part of it was because they said, one, they didn't want to be supporting the government that they opposed, but the other was they thought that it was an imposition on free press. And so that was the prevailing notion around the sales tax on newspapers. Now, in California in 1991, as the Assemblyman said, California ruled to impose a sales tax, but it wasn't on all newspapers. As I understand it, it was just on newspapers sold by a third party, so a vendor, a grocery store, a transaction, a retail transaction. It was my understanding from the California Board of Equalization that the sales tax on subscription newspapers, which is the overwhelming majority in most places, not every place, but most places.
Well, certainly in Southern California, very few comparatively are sold in stores or on the street.
Right, right. And so that was my understanding. I could be flawed, and the assemblyman might correct us on that, but that's my understanding of what happened in 91. In addition to that, I will say, and again, I stipulate, I think the Assemblyman's heart is in the right place on this, but I wonder whether anybody really makes a decision on whether they're going to buy a newspaper based on whether there's a sales tax. My suspicion is that they make a decision based on whether or not they're going to read a newspaper and whether they're going to read it online or in their hand or whatever. I just wonder whether this is even in my mind when I'm buying a newspaper.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask you, because New Jersey, has gone even further here. They set aside $5 million that came from the sale of public television licenses in that big auction that took place, the federal government presided over. So, and they're putting that money into a consortium that funds specific journalistic projects, done by community newspapers. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, it's an interesting idea. I'm not thrilled by it. They originally started with $100 million, then went to $20 million, then $5 million. It's, again, the heart's in the right place, but I always get uncomfortable when I see government trying to, in a good-natured way, trying to help media. But what happens traditionally is when government gets involved in subsidizing media, government wants to tell media what to do. And the second piece of it is sort of, what do we call media these days? Who gets the money? I mean, why would a newspaper get the money versus a website versus a television or radio station? It just gets too complicated. So I think that the intention is good, but the execution of it gets pretty messy. And $5 million, truthfully, is not enough to change very much. I want to apologize. I've got to make an airplane here.
Yeah, we'll let you go. It's good timing for us, too. Thank you so much, Al Tompkins. Always a pleasure. Appreciate it. Senior faculty for broadcast and online journalism at the Poynter Institute. Nice he was able to take the time before he jumps on a flight. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we're going to spend the rest of the hour with Phil Washington, the CEO of Metro. So many of you want to ask him questions about public transit, share your concerns. This, of course, amid a downturn in ridership on Metro. Number of challenges that the agency faces. We're going to talk about them coming right up. And then in our second hour, KPCC infrastructure reporter Sharon McNary with us. She'll have all the details on the settlement announced today between the state, the city of L.A., the county of Los Angeles, with SoCalGas over the Porter Ranch Aliso blowout there. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us. Great to have back with us the CEO of Metro, Phil Washington, as we focus on issues in public transit. Phil, good morning. Thanks for joining us again.
Good morning, Larry. It's great to be here.
So let's start right off. A number of challenges, number of important issues in public transit. One of the things, there's just been approval of efforts to speed up the Orange Bus Line by, 20% along that route with crossing gates, grade separation. Briefly share with us how this is going to work.
Yes, the L.A. Metro Board recently approved some plans for up to 35 crossing gates and two busway and bicycle grade separations from the San Fernando Valley's Orange Line. We believe that this plan will greatly improve both safety and the performance and prepare the bus line for future rail, light rail, which is in our Measure M plan as well. These improvements, the gate crossings, the grade separations are funded through Measure M and also Senate Bill 1 funds as well. And we'll start this work early next year, completed in about 4 or 5 years. But all these improvements, we expect that cut the travel times by approximately 20%. So we're pretty excited about that.
What's the average travel time on the busway right now from end to end?
From end to end, I want to say it's about 30 minutes or so.
Okay.
We look to cut that.
So we're talking Chatsworth to North Hollywood or back.
That's
and obviously
correct.
Time of day, that's going to vary. This would presumably make the travel time more consistent as well if you're able to stop traffic.
Absolutely. It's more predictable. Our schedule will be more predictable. It's going to be a lot faster than driving.
Now, one of the trade-offs there is that when you have the gates like that, it can back up street traffic. Our studios are very close here to crossings for the Gold Line where traffic backs up. Gates are down for a long time, even before and after the trains pass. Is this something being looked at to try and minimize those backups on the north-south crossings?
Yes, we'll look at traffic impacts as well. I think that when you talk about, a bus full of people right now or a train full of people, the thought is that they should have priority over a single occupancy vehicle as well. So we're looking at the traffic impact. We don't think it will be that bad. Right now we're talking about a bus rapid transit and not a train right now. So it's not a long light rail train that we're talking about on the Orange Line.
I understand about prioritizing, but there are times when traffic is so backed up at crossings of the Gold Line, I can't speak the others, there are almost certainly more people in those cars in total than are on the train that are going during some of the times of day. So you're inconveniencing actually more people to help a smaller group of people.
Right. We're looking to minimize that, and we'll continue to look to do that to get those trains through those intersections as quickly as possible.
We welcome questions for Phil Washington, the CEO of Metro. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You can also tweet a question at AirTalk. Robert in Venice says, even when traffic is awful, the expo to downtown L.A. is slower than driving a car. We need tunnels, not something that's affected by traffic. This relates to what we're talking about in the San Fernando Valley with the Orange Busway. Phil, your response to Robert on the Expo line.
Yeah, the Expo line, we are working with the city of Santa Monica and other cities along that line to speed up the service on the Expo line. We are excited about some of the things that we're looking at, and that includes signal synchronization. That includes a number of other things to speed up service. So I think what you'll see on the Expo line is faster service in the near future.
All right, 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. A few weeks ago, Pasadena announced it's going to pull out of its partnership with Metro over the bike share program that has Metro bikes at various locations near public transit or areas where people commonly go. You have to be disappointed about losing that partnership.
Yes, but we've made several major improvements across the county to the program to make using the shared bicycles more affordable and easier to use. For single rides, we've reduced the price from $3.50 to $1.75 for each 30-minute trip. Day pass is being offered at $5 a day, a monthly pass at $17. And since we started the bike share program, we've had 470,000 trips. We've registered about 1.4 million miles of travel. We do plan to expand the service to include a number of other cities, Culver City, Marina del Rey, Palms, and several other cities. But in total, nearly 700 additional bikes and 79 additional stations are expected to be installed by mid-2019. So we're expanding the program, improving the program, and we look forward to working with Pasadena in the future.
The electric scooters have exploded in popularity, particularly in the beach areas. And I wonder what you see that as a direct competition and going to make it less likely that people will want to rent bikes.
I don't know if it's competition. We would hope that the scooters we can work with the scooter stakeholders, if you will. I don't know if it's direct competition. We actually encourage, you know, any mode of mobility and actually exercise in this case. So we encourage that. We want to look to see how we can play in the scooter arena, if you will, and we'll take a look at that.
Let's talk with Bobby in North Hollywood. You're on Air Talk with Metro CEO Phil Washington.
Hi, guys. My question is regarding the Metro delivering passengers to LAX. I know that was a project that was on the discussion block a while. And then also, I know there's a topic of discussion around getting people in and out of LAX faster with the use of light rail or some other type of modality. I just was hoping for an update on that because I'm from North Hollywood to LAX, and I would love to take the train.
No, it's a good question. I didn't have that on my list of things to ask, Bobby. I'm really glad you raised that. What's the update?
Yes, thank you for the question, Bobby. We are moving that project forward. The Crenshaw line will connect to the airport station. So the Crenshaw line is about 85% complete. The airport station, which will be on the Crenshaw line, we are building that now. Now, we're partnering with LAWA or LAX. They are building a people mover that will go from the terminals out to our stations. So they are building that people mover. It's about a mile and a half, 2 miles that will come from the terminal to our station. They are building that right now. We're building the airport station right now. And the light rail line, which is the Crenshaw line, will be open prior to that. So we are very, very close to having that connection to LAX. We're very, very excited about it. It's in our Measure M plan. And actually, that connection is it's listed as the top project in Measure M right now. And so we're moving that forward, and you're going to see a connection very, very soon.
What's the projected completion date?
Right now, the airport, we're talking about that people mover. So that is about 2.5, 3 years out or so. We will have the station done prior to that, but we're working in conjunction with LAX to get that done.
And just to clarify, the people mover at the airport, that's going to go loop from terminal to terminal and then come out to that Crenshaw station?
It will have a set on and off station at the terminal. And so folks will have to walk to that station, which will probably be either in the middle of the terminal area.
So there won't be a stop at each terminal?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. And what about the Green Line? Is there a way of connecting that up so you don't have to take a shuttle?
We want to look at that Green Line connection. Keep in mind that on the Crenshaw Line, we have actually connected and did a sort of a tie-in to the Green Line on the Crenshaw Line. So that's already done, and that will open up, that tie-in will open up with the Crenshaw Line as well.
So that's a north-south connector off the Green Line to the Crenshaw?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. So that takes care of that. Mm-hmm. All right. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Paul in Woodland Hills says, I love taking the Red Line to Clipper games, but coming home, there are fewer trains and delays. We end up not taking the train because of that. Is Metro aware of that? And are they planning on increasing the number of trains after major events?
Well, we do that right now. Now, we need to look at what Paul is talking about in terms of the Clipper games and whether they're pretty late probably getting out in terms of the games. But we typically have a special event plan that includes additional rail cars, buses. So that's something we'll take a look at. We typically take a look at the schedules for the Clipper games, the Laker games, and we put more service out there.
You do, so okay.
We'll take a look at that.
Yeah, I figured you do that for the Dodgers, particularly with the Gold Line, and obviously for the Ram games, the Expo's packed.
Right, it is. It is standing room only for the Rams games. But we'll look at the basketball.
All right. Let's see. Let's talk with Ahmed in Santa Monica. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was just wondering about the bike paths along the Expo line, and is there any plans to improve those? One of the ways to improve traffic is to encourage more bikers and cyclists along the commute from downtown to the west side and back. And I was wondering if... you know, there are many problems where the paths are constantly being cut off. It's completely nuts how it's all being done from one intersection to the other. So there's no continuous path. And it gets crazy around Culver City, just all along the route. Are there any plans to improve that?
We do have some plans in our Measure M initiative to improve bike paths around the county. Now, we need to look at the bike path that runs adjacent to the Expo line to see where the funding comes from to improve that. But our goal is to improve bike paths all over the county that that we have funding to do. So we'll take a look at the bike path around or along the Expo line and see if we have the funds to improve that. We are very interested in, again, improving bike paths all over the county.
John in Claremont says, I've been hearing Metro's looking at reducing bus service and farming it out to local bus systems. Is that true?
Well, we take a look to the tune of three times a year at all of our bus service throughout the county. And we do have some bus service that is farmed out to some of the munis, we call them. There's 24 separate bus companies out there, and we fund them all. It depends on what route we're talking about. But we look at this service three times a year. If it makes sense for a local bus company to run that service, we will take a hard look at that. But if it's better that we run it, we'll retain that service. So we take a look across the system. Not knowing exactly what route John is talking about, I would say just keep your eyes on our website and see exactly which routes we will farm out. But if it makes sense, we'll do that.
I assume a lot of this are
routes that go within a city. I mean, because yes. there you Metro wouldn't necessarily need to provide the transportation.
That's right. Big Blue Bus, Foothill Transit.
LA Dash,
all of those types of services.
We'll continue our conversation with the CEO of Metro, Phil Washington. We're taking your calls at 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdy's. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Phil Washington, the CEO of Metro, with us. Phil, I've had several listeners who've said they're Orange Line commuters and it's 40 minutes even without traffic, and that the schedule even says that, so they just wanted to offer their correction. They thought your 30 minutes is overly optimistic.
Well, thank you for that. But we're going to cut that 40 minutes by 20% with these new improvements. So thank you for that.
All right. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. We've also got a comment from a listener, Marvin, in North Hollywood. He's wondering, has maintenance been deferred? I've seen a lot of broken fare boxes, escalators and elevators often out of service at the stations. Phil, are there problems keeping up with maintenance needs?
No, I don't think so. We have not deferred any maintenance. We have a pretty aggressive state of good repair program. So if you see escalators out of service, now we check those usually at least on a day-to-day basis, so or daily basis. So if you see those out of service, please call and let us know. But we're not deferring any maintenance right now.
A homelessness serious problem throughout the city. Metro's aspect of this are people who are spending their days or their nights in transit facilities or on trains and on buses. One of the things you're looking at are providing public restrooms, even showers for people. How do you avoid those becoming places where homeless Angelenos hang out, spend time, and that they're not available for the typical rider?
Well, let me just say that we have a homeless outreach program that began about a year ago, and currently we have two teams of outreach workers that walk through our subway stations and ride trains on weekday mornings and afternoons, helping people find housing and other services. We are about to expand this program to provide six additional more outreach teams. These are teams of five people. These are mental health specialists. These are one is a former homeless person. And they will, this expansion of this program will have our teams riding on Saturdays, Sundays, overnight. And so we've also identified five properties, including parking lots along the Orange Line in the San Fernando Valley and a former bus yard in Venice that could be used to provide services or temporary housing for the homeless population. Our board has not weighed in on that. These properties are currently vacant or underused, but it's still unclear what type of services will be provided at these sites or how we as an agency would address public safety and public health. But this is an issue that we're looking very, very closely at, and our board is looking very closely at it as well.
Well, and as the city of L.A. and Orange County have been dealing with, often proposed sites might seem ideal, and then residents and businesses nearby push back against it because yes. of what they think it'll mean to the quality of life in those communities.
Absolutely.
So that's, you know, even if the board decides to go forward, it doesn't mean that the communities will welcome this.
That's exactly right. And we have been talking to those businesses, and we have been doing outreach to those businesses. We don't know where we will end up, but the first line of defense are those teams, those homeless outreach teams that I talked about that is engaging with the homeless that ride our trains.
How are you going to keep the restrooms and showers that are created from becoming places where people spend considerable time? Are you going to have security there? How do you deal with that?
Well, we have to work all those things out. You know, my guess is we would, if we go in this direction, which we haven't not decided yet, and our board has not decided yet, there would need to be some type of service there, security and that sort of thing. But we haven't gone there yet. It's still in the formative stages. And we'll let folks know if we decide to do that.
Okay. Any timeline on the board taking that up?
My guess would be the next within the next 3 to 6 months or so.
All right. Also, security, an ongoing issue. I think every time you visit, we talk about security along the buses and the rail lines. We had the incident with the young woman who was ejected from the Red Line train where the video went viral. And there was criticism of your response, criticism of the officer removing the people. And we when we talked about this, we had a caller who mentioned about LAPD not enforcing the code of conduct. And after that program, I got an email from a listener who says he is a detective for LAPD and a regular listener to the show. And I just want to read the email that was sent to me by this listener who says he's an LAPD detective. So I was listening to your podcast today on my way home, like I usually do, particularly liked your piece on the homeless problem on the MTA lines. One of your callers mentioned LAPD has a memoranda instructing officers not to enforce the MTA code of conduct. I can tell you from firsthand knowledge, the LAPD has instructed us not to enforce the code of conduct. I've never seen an actual memoranda, but I've worked MTA overtime details several times. Every time we do our roll calls before deploying on the line, our supervisors tell us not to enforce the code of conduct. We're told the MTA won't back us, that I'll look bad when we get into use of forces enforcing MTA codes, and it won't look pretty. They say that we might get banned from working another overtime shift if things turn sideways. And sure enough, the MTA didn't back up that sergeant when it didn't look pretty on video. But this unwritten rule comes from both agencies, MTA and LAPD. MTA doesn't want to alienate passengers. They don't want to look bad publicly. They hired LAPD to do the dirty job, but they don't want to publicly condone how LAPD does it. And LAPD doesn't want to jeopardize the MTA contract, so officers are left just walking around to presume public safety. They'll respond to calls of service, but rarely will they enforce the code of conduct. The detective didn't want his name shared, but Phil, your response to that claim?
Well, I'm not aware of any directives to not enforce the code of conduct. I'm not aware of that. We have not issued any type of directive to LAPD or the sheriffs or Long Beach Police Department, which is our three-agency model. We have not issued such a directive. So I'm not aware of that. In the meantime, crime on our system has gone down. It has actually decreased. So our code of conduct, yes, we want it enforced, and we will work. And I have met with the new chief of LAPD, and we have a great working relationship. And right now, all of our three-agency law enforcement model is doing very, very well, and I look forward to working with them in the future.
Law enforcement been removing people who violate the code of conduct and refuse to stop their behavior that violates the code?
I want to say that they have really been enforcing the code of conduct. They have, I don't know about any removals right offhand right now. I can't say that I know of any, but I'm sure that they're happening if folks are not complying with the code of conduct. But right now, I think that things are working very, very well. I think everyone learned from that incident, and we're moving forward.
We'll continue our conversation with CEO of Metro, Phil Washington. Much more to talk about, the Crenshaw extension to West Hollywood, what the timeline's looking for that, money allocated for the Gold Line extension all the way to the county line in Montclair. We'll talk about additional safety measures for the Gold Line as it goes along the 210 freeway, and also bus drivers, whether protective barriers are going to be installed in Metro buses. What does that mean then for passengers if drivers end up behind protective barriers? It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle with Metro CEO Phil Washington. We're taking your calls and interspersing those with some of the questions that I've got about what's happening with Metro. One of the things we want to mention is that a bill in Sacramento provides protective barriers for bus drivers, as we've had some terrible incidents of bus drivers assaulted by people. Phil, your thoughts on this? And obviously, you know, no one wants to see a driver at risk or harmed. But is the trade-off of that potentially make it more difficult for drivers to know what's going on back in the bus and maybe intervene if necessary?
Well, Representative Grace Napolitano has introduced a bill, which we support, that requires transit agencies to install protective driver barriers on all buses to improve bus operator safety. Now, Metro, we have already been leading the charge in this effort. We have a 2,200 bus fleet. And to date, we have over 1,300 buses with driver barriers installed. And newer buses that are now on order will come with these barriers as standard equipment. Over the years, we've seen an increase in operator assaults. It's a terrible thing. What we've said and what we've tried to articulate to the public is, listen, these drivers, they're somebody's mother, they're somebody's brother, they're somebody's sister, they're somebody's father. They're just simply coming to work. In 2014, the assaults reached 141 people. Or operators. In 2015, that number surged to 170 operators. And then in 2016, it dropped to 120. And then last year, it was about 125, 130. So we take this violence against our bus operators very, very seriously.
And they're very vulnerable. Just because where they are in the bus, they're a sitting duck. If someone, there's nowhere to go.
That's right. That's right. And I get the emails of every incident, any incident that's out in the field, and it just breaks my heart when a bus operator is assaulted. So these barriers are helping keep the operator safe. Now, incidents that happen on the bus, they're asked to call the authorities. They have communication ways to communicate with law enforcement, so they can still do that. But the number one priority for us is our bus operator safety, and we think these barriers help with that.
Have you had any drivers who've complained and said, you know, I know I'm at greater risk without a barrier, but I want to be able, if I make the decision, if I want to step in to protect someone, I want that option.
Yes, we have. We've had operators that talk about that, and we have not necessarily made the use of the barriers mandatory. We are talking to the various labor unions. We want to work with them who represent the bus operators. But I feel that it is my job to make sure that these barriers are in place to protect bus operators, but we have not made it mandatory for them to use it.
Rachel in downtown Los Angeles, you're on Air Talk. Your question for Phil Washington of Metro.
Yes, I'm calling because I just recently, Metro has changed the prices of the passes. It was at one point, at first it was $7 for a day pass, $25 for a biweekly pass, and $100 for a monthly pass. Now they've done away with the day passes, and it's stored value. So whenever you get on the bus, you pay, or you can reload your tap card. And if you want it, you can go to a local venue to purchase your pass. However, it's $25 a week rather than $25 for 2 weeks. Why do they change it?
Well, that I will need to look into. We want to hear input from you. What we're trying to do with our pass program now is right price our passes. And so we are talking to our board right now. There's been no policy decision on fares right now, but we are looking to see how we can right price these passes. We will look into why that was changed. And my hope is that you will call our call line to get further information on that. But we will look into that.
Rachel, thank you for your call. Let's talk about the Crenshaw extension to West Hollywood. What's the timeline for that?
Well, right now in Measure M, and what we're talking about is a rail line from the terminus of the current Crenshaw LAX project at Exposition in Crenshaw to the Red Line at Hollywood. In the Measure M plan, that extension up to West Hollywood is further out in the plan. It's something like 2040, 2045. What we're trying to do now, along with a number of other projects, is accelerate this project. So we don't have a timeline as of yet in terms of the acceleration. We have a program that we have initiated called 28 by 2028, which is 28 projects that we're looking to do in the next 10 years by 2028, which is the Olympics. These projects are light rail projects, they're highway improvement projects, they're various other projects. The Crenshaw North Extension, in order to accelerate that project to West Hollywood, we need some help from either the private sector or local communities to accelerate that project. But right now, in the Measure M plan, is further out.
This is about 30 years in the
yes.
current plan. All right. Also, wanted to ask you about the Montclair State extension of the Gold Line. What's the timeline for that?
Well, in last December, we broke ground on that extension from Azusa to Claremont and eventually to Montclair. It is going through various cities consisting of five stations for 11 miles. Right now, the completion is set for 2026-2027 with the hope of accelerating that line. Right now, there will be a contract awarded for the design and construction for the construction of that line here in the next few months. So we will be building that line. It's the first line in Measure M that we broke ground on. So we're very excited about it.
Quick question from Macon and Glendale, wondering about the ability to connect from the Gold Line to the Expo Line. Is the downtown connector going to provide that?
Yes, the regional connector, which is really going to be a game changer. That project is almost 50% complete.
We've seen all the construction downtown for that.
Right, right. So that will be the connector for the entire system. And so what we're talking about is the ability to go from eventually Montclair all the way down to Long Beach, pretty much with a one-seat ride.
All right. Phil Washington, always a pleasure. We'll look forward to seeing you again soon. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Phil Washington, the CEO of LA Metro, with us on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We have a lot coming up in our second hour, including Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Richard Rhodes. He won the Pulitzer for The Making of the Atomic Bomb. His new book is no less than A History of Energy.
KPCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, helping businesses improve their bottom line with solar water heating. The system preheats your water using the strength of the sun. It works with your existing natural gas water heater to warm your water in a reliable and efficient way. You may save on your SoCal Gas bill and get rebates that may cover up to 80% of the system's cost. With these rebates, heating water with the sun could be a sound investment. It's the strength of the sun in your business. Learn more at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us today. I hope your day's off to a great start. Coming up a little bit later this hour, Children's advocates want the American Psychological Association to condemn the use of psychologists to come up with ways to keep people online more. They think that that harms children. We'll talk about that and debate the issue a little bit later. But first, a settlement has been reached between the city of L.A., the county of Los Angeles, and SoCal Gas. This after the Aliso Canyon massive leak of methane back in 2015. KPCC reporter Sharon McNary is at that news conference. Sharon, good morning. What are the details?
It's $19.5 million. SoCal Gas has agreed to what looks like a couple different funds. Some of it will go to greenhouse gas mitigation to compensate for all the greenhouse gases that got released when all that methane went into the air. There'll be money for local environmental projects. $21 million of it is to civil penalties. And then the government plaintiffs, the city and county, will actually get their legal costs covered. That's $19 million right there.
All right. You cut out when you were giving the total amount. How much is the total settlement?
Oh, the total is $119.5 million.
All right. And can SoCal Gas pass this on to consumers when we pay our natural gas bills?
That is actually an explicit provision of the settlement that they may not pass it on to ratepayers. It has to come out of the money, the shareholders, the company's profits.
Okay. And this is just one of many legal actions against the gas company resulting from the Aliso Canyon leak. What are some of the others?
Okay, well, what's getting settled today are the claims brought by the City of Los Angeles, the County of Los Angeles, the State Attorney General, and the California Air Resources Board. What's not being settled today are the 48,000 plaintiffs who have filed more than 300 lawsuits claiming individual damages, such as injuries to their health or damage to their businesses while Porter Ranch was a virtual ghost town over the 4 months that the leak was active.
Okay, and are those in a class action? Have they been combined, or are those in clumps of cases?
Both, actually. There are class actions that affect everybody in the area, and if they don't want to be part of that, they can opt out. But there are also individual claims for damages, which would be, like, specific to your situation. Like, you know, I had to go to the doctor 18 times because of the leak. That's an individual case.
We have any sense of what the total financial exposure could be to SoCal Gas after this?
I don't. I mean, I reported earlier this week, they have these quarterly reports they have to make to their shareholders. They've now topped $1 billion with a B, dollars in costs for the gas disaster. Their insurance is going to cover $1.2 to $1.4 billion of that. So they're actually kind of like getting close to running out of insurance money. And I don't honestly know if the money in this settlement gets paid for by insurance or if it comes from some other place.
All right. The leak, just to remind our listeners, the largest single release of methane in U.S. history. It lasted nearly 4 months, caused thousands of people to move out of their homes for some period of time and required remediation of those homes, ongoing concerns about the health consequences of that massive leak. And Sharon, before I let you go, just remind our listeners, I know we talked about this, but much less gas is now being stored at that site under less pressure?
Right. The gas storage field, which is really an underground rock formation that used to hold petroleum, it's being they're allowing a lower volume than it, you know, ultimately could hold. That means the pressure to operate it is less. But they're actually not allowed to take any gas out of it unless we're in some kind of an energy emergency. If it looks like the lights would go out because the power plants don't have natural gas, then they can take gas out of that field. And that's happened a couple of times in the past 3 years since the leak broke out. Oh, and I should add, there's $25 million in this settlement. It's unclear what portion it comes from, but there's $25 million that the county is saying will be used for a long-term health study of the people in Porter Ranch.
All right. Sharon, anything else to add before I let you go? I understand there's still more questions there at the news conference.
There are. In fact, I snuck out and locked myself into a copy room so I could have a quiet place to talk. You know, they're talking about the timing of it. It feels kind of, I mean, it raises the question, why settle now when the discovery in the other litigation cases are only now starting to say what came out of the hole that blew open, including benzene, for which there's no safe level. So there's still a lot of questions to be answered, and all of the officials talking about this are saying, yes, we've settled our cases, but there's still a lot to be known. And the Public Utilities Commission also has a lot of inquiry that they're doing, including into the root cause of the gas well blowout in the first place.
So, if there's still more information that could have informed the settlement, what would be the motivation to settle earlier? I mean, the attorney general is, you know, running for re-election in November. I mean, what are the possible issues here?
Well, you know, they might have been eyeing that insurance payout potential and saying if we don't get ours now, there might not be some there. You know, various utilities are saying that the cost of fires caused by their electrical power, and remember, SoCalGas has an electric utility in San Diego, you know, that's costing utilities a lot of money and putting them at financial risk. It's really hard to say, but it could have been on the SoCalGas side. You know, they're seeing more information come out about this benzene. Maybe they figured, you know, best to cut the deal now than wait for more information to come out. You know, I'm not in the room when these things are being talked about, so it's really hard to figure out. And of course, you know, the officials aren't being too outspoken about like what the conversations were.
You should be there, Sharon. We'll see if we can get you access to those.
No, and when mind reading becomes a reporter's skill.
All right. Sharon, we'll let you get back to the news conference. Thank you so much. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Sharon McNary, infrastructure correspondent for KPCC in downtown Los Angeles, for the announcement of this settlement between the state of California, the State Air Resources Board, L.A. City, L.A. County, with SoCalGas over the Aliso Canyon methane blowout in Porter Ranch. Also want to mention SoCalGas is an underwriter financial supporter of KPCC. Yesterday, as we were starting off on Air Talk, a perplexing tweet was launched by Elon Musk of Tesla, where he said he was thinking about taking Tesla private. That tweet not only included that he was looking at taking over control of the company that he had founded, but also mentioned a specific price, which was a bit of a shocker. He said, "I'm considering taking Tesla private at $420, funding secured." A short time later, after the price of Tesla's stock spiked, trading was halted in it until later in the day. The question is there any precedent for a CEO of a company coming out and tweeting the intention to take a company private and for a specific price? And does that potentially run afoul of Securities and Exchange Commission rules or even the law? With us is John Coffey, professor at Columbia School of Law, where he specializes in corporate law and securities fraud. Professor Coffey, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Are you aware of any precedent for a CEO doing this?
There are precedents for CEOs making all kinds of statements on Twitter. And the SEC will let you do that if you properly warned your shareholders that you'll make these market-moving announcements on Twitter. But no one else has made this kind of truly epically market-moving statement. And we have to ask, what was he thinking? He obviously did not talk to any lawyer or advisor, or they would have insisted that he simultaneously file this statement in a press release with the SEC on a Form 8K, that he put it on the company website, and then the company put out a formal press release all at once. That would have at least made somewhat simpler the question of who knew this and when. But the bigger issue is the factual statement he made. He may have just been musing about this possibility or seen it as a long-term plan. But the moment he said funding secured, he's made a factual representation about present facts. and that affects the market. The biggest issue on any kind of leverage buyout is whether they can get the financing for it. And the financing here is going to be enormous in scale. He is proposing the world's largest leverage buyout, nearly twice as large as the previous leader, which was about $36 billion a decade ago. And to do this, he has to get a tremendous amount of debt, maybe as much as $50 billion to finance this. And that's very difficult to see as plausible for a company like Tesla, which is frankly operating at negative cash flow. Leverage buyouts are usually done by big public utilities or other companies with safe, secure cash flow. That's not Tesla, which is still at the startup stage and may have very volatile quarters. So it all looks very hard to see as a really carefully thought-out plan. It may have been sort of an inspired musing or a somewhat reckless off-the-cuff comment, but it's really impacted the market.
I'm trying to think of other prominent Americans who do such a thing, muse on Twitter without really, you know, thinking through the consequences or what the legal ramifications could be. John Coffey, professor at Columbia School of Law, joining us on Air Talk. So let's say hypothetically he doesn't really have all the financing aligned and doesn't follow through with this, and yet what he did affected the price of the stock. Is that a problem?
Definitely. This can violate Rule 10b-5. Remember, first of all, there are a large number of short sellers. Yesterday, when the price spiked, they lost an estimated $1.3 billion. They are very motivated to sue to get some of that back, and their claim will be that he made a reckless, unsupported statement, possibly in order to manipulate the stock price and punish them as short sellers. I don't know about the motive, but I do know that it's going to be very hard to substantiate that that funding was secured, and that will move the market, and the short sellers have that cause of action. Other people who bought yesterday may find that the stock price declines in the future when more details come out about the existence or non-existence of this funding. And if the stock price falls, that could be a second group that sues. So we have a half-completed story. This is a little like the man being shot out of the cannon, and we don't know the outcome until he lands. And we're still a day or two away from that.
What do you suspect or know is going on at the SEC in response to this?
Well, the SEC may sit back and let private plaintiffs sue. This is not the way they like to see things done, but there was a prior precedent involving Netflix and its CEO, Mr. Hastings, Reed Hastings, several years ago, in which the SEC could say that if you have warned your shareholders that you'll make market-moving announcements on Twitter or other social media, we'll consider that an adequate public statement. And in the case of Tesla, the Twitter account here for Mr. Musk may have as many as 70 million followers. So there's a strong argument that it was a public statement. That doesn't mean anything, though, in terms of whether this is a false or materially misleading public statement. And that's where I think the litigation interest is going to focus.
We're talking with John Coffey, professor, Columbia School of Law. He specializes in white-collar crime, corporate law, and securities fraud, talking about yesterday's tweet from Tesla CEO Elon Musk that he'd secured funding for taking Tesla private at $420 a share. So just clarify, typically this would be done in an SEC filing, and I'm assuming simultaneously a public release.
Yes, that's how you normally would do it in order to get maximum penetration into the market. The SEC has recognized that at some point, if you tell the world that you're going to do it, you can make statements on social media. And in fact, Tesla has in the past indicated that their CEO may from time to time make public statements on his Twitter account. So I won't say that would be the principal theme the SEC would raise. I suspect that they'll sit back and let the private plaintiff sue because Mr. Musk is a deep pocket, and there are lots of people who have lost money, and there's no reason why the plaintiff's bar is not going to pursue this case aggressively.
Professor Coffey, we thank you for being with us and explaining this and sharing your thoughts.
Very good.
Thanks, John Coffey, Columbia Law professor, joining us on Air Talk. Coming right up, we're going to take a look at a call by children's activists for the American Psychological Association to condemn the use by tech companies of psychologists to come up with ever more effective ways to keep us and kids on the keyboard. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in just a minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up next, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Richard Rhodes. His book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, seemingly won every award in the world of literature that there was. His new book is Energy, A Human History. And fascinating to see how much Benjamin Franklin had to do with it above and beyond his famous kite. We'll talk about the evolution of various forms of energy and energy depletion coming up right here on 89.3. But first, children's advocates want the American Psychological Association to condemn the tech industry's practice of using persuasive psychological techniques to keep kids, and adults as well, glued to their screens. The advocates say there's research that excessive use of social media and video games leads to depression and academic troubles, and so they say it's unethical for psychologists to be involved in coming up with ways to get kids to spend more time on apps and online. Joining us to talk about the issue is Richard Fried, a child and adolescent psychologist based in the East San Francisco Bay community of Walnut Creek. He's author of Wired Child, Reclaiming Childhood in a Digital Age. Thank you very much, Richard Fried, for joining us.
Thank you, Larry.
So share with us your concerns about this. Do you think it is an ethical dilemma for psychologists to do this work?
Every day, I'm a clinician. Every day I work with kids and families in my practice whose lives are really being torn apart by kids' profound overuse of video games, social media, and smartphones. And these parents are wondering, how come my kid can't get off the device? How come my kid throws their chair through the wall or puts their fist through a wall? Or sometimes kids are getting psychiatrically hospitalized if they overuse their devices and parents try to get them to back off. Parents want to know why these devices are so are leading kids to use them compulsively. And then we see, well, why is that? Well, so much of the products that are being developed are social media, video games. We see all these experimental psychologists working for industry with the main purpose to get kids and adults to spend more and more time on these devices. So I think it's something that really needs to be addressed.
We have a long-standing history in this country of targeting kids to sell stuff with them. And I mean, this goes back to the early days of radio and through television, selling stuff to them from breakfast cereal to toys and, you know, trying to get them to do all kinds of things. So, is this in line with that, do you think? Or are we talking about something magnitude different?
Larry, that's a good question. I really think we have a magnitude of difference because it's really about persuasive design. It's this perfect coming together of digital devices plus the latest academic psychology, and it's really come to be able to build these remarkably powerful tools which are far more seductive, and in the case of video games, we've recently called them addictive, so it's really changed the game about how seductive and how powerful these devices are. And it's led this generation of kids to far overuse their devices at the expense of their well-being. They're getting depressed. They're also, many kids are getting addicted. They're also, especially for our boys, not doing well in school. And the National Bureau of Economic Research is saying this whole generation of boys and young men aren't going off to get jobs. Instead, they are staying at home to play video games.
I guess I wonder, though, you know, where do you draw the line? Because there are all kinds of things that tech companies do to make the apps, to make the websites compelling for people, the way they're laid out, the design, all these sorts of things. I mean, would you extend this beyond just the psychologists who are coming up with ways of figuring out how the brain interacts with the site?
I think psychologists, because they are beholden to their ethics, if you look at psychologists' ethics, there are clear indications that we are to do no harm. There are clear indications that we are not to use subterfuge and secrecy, and we're not to exploit vulnerable populations. What's happening now is going completely against the ethics of the profession of psychology. So we have, as psychology as a profession, we have a duty to really step up and help children and families who are being affected by this.
We're talking with psychologist Richard Fried. He specializes in working with adolescent and children in his practice. He also focuses on kids' use of technology. He's author of Wired Child, Reclaiming Childhood in a Digital Age. I'd really be interested in your take on this if you're a psychological professional, what you think about this. You know, a lot of research psychologists have gone into the tech sector because there are, you know, high-paying jobs that are there to be involved in research for various startups and different platforms, app developers and the like. What do you think about psychologists working in this area to try and, you know, provide research on the best ways to get people attracted to and spending more time on devices and specific digital locations? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us, consumer research psychologist Kit Yarrow, professor at Golden Gate University in San Francisco, and author of Decoding the New Consumer Mind, How and Why We Shop and Buy. Kit Yarrow, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry.
So what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that the APA should come out and take a stand against this?
I don't think it'd be a bad idea, and I don't disagree with anything that your other guests mentioned. I think that we do have an ethical obligation to use our knowledge wisely and for the benefit of the community. On the other hand, I don't think that any company is going to deliberately make their product unattractive or less compelling. That will never be an implemented business strategy. To me, the beauty of this letter to the APA and getting publicity around this letter is where I think the most important intervention is going to occur, and that's in education. So I think really most kids don't misuse technology. In no way are most kids not getting jobs because they're using technology. It absolutely is a problem, not saying it's not. It's just that if most kids are not misusing technology and most kids are not addicted to technology, I don't know that making unattractive video games is going to be the solution. I think the solution is in educating parents, offering safeguards. Like, I would love technology companies to do more around offering automatic shutoffs, more parental controls, much more education about how video games become addictive. And I think things like sending the letter to the APA, I don't believe the APA is going to take a stance on this, but sending the letter is a good way of getting the message out to the public. And I think parents absolutely have to figure out why their kid might want to be choosing gaming over other activities. So it could be something about the rest of the kid's life. It could be something about the games. But we've got to engage our kids in other ways, and we also have to limit their exposure to technology. There's no way around that. It's not healthy for kids to be overusing technology.
Listener Pippi writes on our AirTalk page, psychologists aren't keeping kids on their devices. Lazy parents who want to be their kid's best friend and don't say no are. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I'm very sympathetic to what Richard Fried is saying, the psychologist. I guess I wonder, though, how do you thread that needle between, you know, trying to make, whether it's a product, an app, whatever it is, attractive to people, somehow, you know, make it something that is of interest to people, a diversion or a value, how you would keep that then from being more attractive to kids, too? And Kit Yarrow, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I know. I think that's exactly the problem we're dealing with. And I think instead of making a product unattractive, what we need to do is build in better controls. And so one of the things that's being implemented now are things like little warning signs. You've been on for 20 minutes, time to take a break, or automatic shutoffs, or ways to manipulate the technology to remind people, hey, it's time to do something else. Have you gone outside? Or like, you know, so I think making the product attractive, that's their job. And most kids are able to manage that. But I think for those where it's problematic, there have to be more safeguards that are built into the technology that parents can choose to use to help their kids manage their time online.
Let's talk with Reed in Thousand Oaks. You're on Air Talk.
Yeah, it's actually, I'm really glad that you just mentioned that, because that's exactly what I was talking about. I think that it's, you know, these corporations are going to make products as attractive as they can, because that's, you know, that's their job. But I think it's our job as parents and as citizens to examine, you know, how we're using these products and then adjust our behaviors to take that into account.
All right, Reed, appreciate the call. Richard Fried, do you want to respond?
Firstly, Dr. Yarrow, thank you very much for your support, and I believe the caller was Reed. Thank you also. One thing I just want to be careful of is just to make sure that we don't blame parents. I work with so many remarkably great parents who are finding that they've still lost their kids to technology. They've done everything they can, but social media products, video games overwhelm the child, and they lose their kid anyway. So we want to be careful not to to blame parents, and we really want to hold the industry accountable for all these secret techniques. Does the public know that all these psychologists are working for industry? When are we going to ask that question? Is that appropriate? Is that a good idea? And does that explain why we're losing our kids? And that's why I'm hoping the APA will really step up. And a lot of this is about informing the consumer and teaching and helping the public understand that right now, unfortunately, psychology is being used as a weapon against kids. The APA really needs to step up and say, we can't have that happen. Instead, we need to be informing the public and help and make sure that psychology is being used as a tool for good.
David in Irvine says, what's the difference between a child spending too much time playing video games versus playing chess? Lots of kids intensely pursue certain gaming activities. Is there something different about using the tech to do so? That's David in Irvine. Richard Fried?
There is absolutely no good academic research that your kid playing chess is going to be hurtful to them. Where I'm sure it's actually quite helpful, where there are thousands, more than 1,000 peer-reviewed, studies and journals that show that video gaming poses significant risks, and other technologies are posing significant risks, leading kids, because today the typical teen in America spends 6 hours and 40 minutes on using their devices to play with. I don't think the typical kid is spending anywhere near 6 hours and 40 minutes playing chess. Instead, that sadly for lower income and for black youth, that number is much higher. So what's happening is that's a remarkable amount of time that's pulling kids away from spending time with family, from engaging in academic activities. And that's why, as Dr. Jean Twenge shows us, there's all this, she's showing us that the more time kids are on their teen, especially girls, are on their smartphones or on social media, that they are much more likely to be depressed and have thoughts of suicide.
All right. Thank you very much, Richard Fried, child and adolescent specialist psychologist in Walnut Creek in the San Francisco Bay Area, author of Wired Child, and our thanks to Kit Yarrow, consumer research psychologist, professor at Golden Gate University, San Francisco, author of Decoding the New Consumer Mind. Ellen in Pasadena says, I have two twin boys, almost 13. It's a real challenge monitoring use of their phones. One's been diagnosed with anxiety, the other depression. I see the device bringing out the worst in them. It's not lazy parents. We're vigilant. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Coming up, we'll talk with Pulitzer Prize winner Richard Rhodes on his new book, Energy, A Human History. First, a live update from Hetty. Well, as we're trying to transition in this country to renewable energy, it's just one of a series of energy transitions that have taken place throughout the course of human history. That evolution is contained in the new book by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Rhodes. Energy, A Human History, follows his multi-award-winning The Making of the Atomic Bomb. Richard Rhodes, great to have you with us today on Air Talk.
Thank you. Good morning.
So where do you place where we are right now in this transition from fossil to renewable energy? How does that compare to earlier transitions?
This is the largest transition of all, I'm sorry to say. Not only is it worldwide, which was never the case before, but it's coming at a time when a large part of the world's population is itself transitioning from poverty, basically, to a more middle-class way of life with all of the increased energy demand that involves. So we've got a double challenge today.
Well, and you write in your book that the previous transitions have been driven by scarcity. That's why we had to find other forms of energy. We have plenty of oil right now. This isn't a scarcity. We've had more natural gas than we've ever had access to. We're doing this for other reasons.
We are. Don't leave out coal. We have, just in the United States alone, 400 years worth of coal. But this time around, it's a more serious and challenging problem in that the very sources of our prosperity throughout the world, meaning these fossil fuels, essentially, are themselves the culprits in the necessity for a transition. I found a number in my research that just knocked me down. In 2015, in August, in northern Iran, the heat index, the combination of temperature and humidity, reached 165 degrees Fahrenheit. I had to go to my cookbook to find something that's that temperature, and it's the temperature of a cooked chicken. So that's what we're facing in the future, and rather soon in the future, it appears, if we can't find a way to decarbonize our energy supply. It's going to be a major, major challenge. It already is.
Well, and you point out that these transitions, whether, you know, even going from firewood to coal, for example, take decades. It's a very, very long process, maybe a century. And you can say, well, maybe we move things much more quickly now because just the pace of technology. But the flip side of that is, as you said, this is global. It's not a regional shift.
Exactly. Some of the scientific work that I looked at, a careful analysis of energy transitions for the last 150 years, indicates that it takes about 100 years to move from 1% of a new source of energy as a fraction of the world's market to 50%, in other words, to dominance. 100 years, we don't have 100 years. And it's not so simple, unfortunately, as simply coming up with a new kind of energy and then installing the equipment. People don't take easily to having to change their lives around in the often very dramatic ways that are involved with energy transitions. One quick example, when the English in 1952 had one of the last of their several killer fogs, some 3,000 people died because of smoke that was mixed up with fog during a period of temperature inversion in London. They had to switch to, first they switched to artificial gas, and then when they discovered natural gas around their islands, they switched to natural gas. But to do that, they had to change all their furnaces, all of their stoves, anything that had used coal before had to be removed and replaced with something that would use these new sources of energy. In addition, people don't like the idea of changing. And in a sense, the worst resistance to these energy transitions is people's attitudes toward the new source of energy. I would cite nuclear power as the most obvious present example. But coal in Elizabethan England was popularly believed to be literally the devil's excrement. And you can imagine trying to switch from lovely wood fire to coal fire in one's home, or try to roast meat over the devil's excrement, basically.
That's pretty funny.
So it was a problem for people.
Well, and it's a great example using the killer London fog, because the change only came when everybody could see what the negative effect was and knew that there was this terrible body count associated with the direct environmental cause of that. Now, in the case of renewables, it's hard because you're trying to say to people, well, here's the sacrifice financially or convenience or otherwise you're going to have to make, or you know, to your standard of living, for something that isn't directly as evident as the London fog.
That's quite true, and it's between scarcity, or more often the increased cost of a supply of fuel, because it had to be collected farther and farther away, and the movement of the material was expensive. That happened with whale oil. As whales got scarce, we had to go farther and farther away to find them, and accordingly the price went up. So over and over again, it's been problems like this that at least are visible to people. They can at least see the benefit. It's not so clear when we're talking about basically different ways to generate electricity, because all we see is the electricity. We don't see where it's being manufactured with coal or whatever source, nuclear power or renewables. Those things are off somewhere. In a way, that's a benefit, because the problem of dealing with the various kinds of pollution that even the cleanest forms of energy produce can be handled collectively somewhere else instead of in your living room. I mean, the Elizabethans didn't have chimneys in most of their houses. They let the wood smoke just drift through the house and out the window. So when coal came along, suddenly they were suffocating with this terrible sulfurous dark smoke in their homes, and they had to retrofit all their houses with chimneys. So it's different with each one, but today is a particularly great challenge.
We're talking with Richard Rhodes, winner of just about every major writing award there is, got the Pulitzer for The Making of the Atomic Bomb. His new book, Energy, A Human History. And just before we take a brief break, I wanted to ask you, you have so many interesting historic tidbits in here about energy, but I didn't realize that gasoline was considered, it was a waste product of distilling petroleum, and then they just dumped it?
Indeed. Gasoline, of course, was refined from oil. Oil was first drilled for in Pennsylvania in 1859, but the search was for something to use to light lamps with, kerosene from oil in this case. The automobile didn't come along until 1900, and even then it wasn't clear that they were going to be powered with gasoline. So it was simply a refinery waste which would be dumped on the ground to evaporate, or more typically thrown into the rivers at night so that no one would have to pay for its disposal. That was the problem. And when the electric light bulb came along, suddenly gasoline and the other petroleum products were really a question. Is there going to continue to be a demand? The automobile came along just in time.
Fascinating. As we continue, we'll talk about the evolution of the battery. Of course, that's central to electric vehicles and the efficiency and storage capacity of batteries. We'll talk about some of the earliest versions, how they've evolved, and the biggest challenges with batteries to come. Richard Rhodes, author of Energy, A Human History, will be back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. A wealth of fascinating information in Richard Rhodes' book, Energy, A Human History. Did you know, for example, that shortly after the turn of the last century, the hydropower facility at Niagara Falls was producing 10% of all the electricity generated in the United States just from the facilities at Niagara Falls. All kinds of fascinating information in Richard Rhodes' book. Richard, wanted to talk about batteries. And you know, what's the earliest example we have of a storage device for energy?
Well, it was the glass bottle with foil on the outside and foil on the inside. It was basically a what are they called? It stored static electricity. That's what Franklin used for all of his great experiments with electricity, including the one where he ran up a kite just before a storm hit. If you look at the pictures that have been drawn of that experiment, there's a young boy standing next to him, and sitting by the young boy is what looks like a jug, which is actually a storage jar for electricity. So those were the first. In fact, Franklin coined the term battery. He borrowed it from the term for battering something with cannon. A row of cannon on a ship was called a battery. So he thought of the battery, again, because you had to line up these Leyden jars, these capacitors. He thought of it along the same lines as a multiple lineup of things that could be discharged suddenly. But that was the problem with the Leyden jar, that you couldn't release the power in a controlled way. It all had to go at once. So the battery itself was invented in 1700. And it was simply a stack of different metals, basically different kinds of coins, with pieces of carbon paper, or rather blotting paper, between each coin that was soaked in salt water. Out of that, you got what is not dramatically different from today's batteries. And those became the only source of electricity other than the Leyden jar, but the only source of continuously released electricity, until the development of the generator, which was not until the 1880s. So for a long stretch of time, from 1700 to the 1880s, the only kind of electricity in the world was low-power, high-amperage electricity of the kind you get from a battery. And that's why when Edison first introduced a generator and generating electricity, he went with the battery-type current, direct current. Unfortunately, direct current doesn't travel well. Someone described, if Edison wanted to run a power line from Wall Street up to 59th Street in New York, the copper wire would be as big around as a man's leg. So
wow.
Edison had a problem with distributing his electricity more than about a half mile from the plant that generated it. And that's where Niagara Falls comes in, because Westinghouse, the other great inventor of this era, had developed alternating current, where the current switches back and forth. And because of its particular characteristics, can be transformed from low voltage to high voltage and transmitted on small wires. So when Niagara Falls was the generating plant was built there in the 1890s, and they realized they had to deliver the power quite a long distance away. There was nothing locally. It was a semi-wilderness around the falls. They went with alternating current, and that was the end of Mr. Edison's direct current systems.
We're talking with Richard Rhodes, Energy, a Human History. So then what are you mentioned that the battery and used very similar to the sort of the first battery storage technology. But then, you know, what were the next most significant battery developments over the years?
Well, I think the most important application at the turn of the 20th century was the automobile. The electric automobile had a great advantage over the gasoline-powered in that it did not have to be cranked to start. This was the years before there was an electric starter motor in the car. Women had trouble turning these very difficult-to-crank cranks. Anyone who's ever cranked an old Model T will know what I'm talking about. Just about takes your arm off. So an electric for women was a much better car. All you had to do was push a button. They loved them for driving around the city. But interestingly, the batteries in 1900 were good in a car for about 30 miles. And we're not that much better now, 100 years later, than we were then. I mean, yes, we're up to 100. Did I say 100 miles? 30 miles. We're up to 100 miles now, maybe even 150. Maybe with a Tesla, if you can afford a Tesla, you can get 300. But by and large, the battery has not been really revolutionized ever since it was first devised.
Well, and
it's made lighter, it's made capable of carrying more charge, but we're still facing the need for a big breakthrough in battery technology.
Well, and this is the problem too with renewable energy, right? Because if it's when the wind's blowing, when you know the sun is shining, you need a way to store it.
Yes, and the batteries that have been devised by the Tesla company for storage really don't store that much for that long. And it would be, at this point, simply impossible to spend the kind of money you would need to store. There's presently a plan to use Hoover Dam as a possible way to store electric charge during the day to release it at night by using excess current during the day to pump water back into the reservoir and then run the water out at night to generate electricity. I think people need to understand, and I know how resistant Americans are to what I'm going to say, but nuclear power is probably one of the most important sources of energy available today to help us deal with global warming. You know, the United States is prosperous enough that we might be able to get by entirely on renewables. But the rest of the world doesn't have that luxury. China and India in particular, with their vast populations, are facing the fact that their air is heavily polluted. A photograph of London in 1850 or Pittsburgh in 1930 looks very much like a photograph of Beijing today. And that's because people typically get their energy first, and then they try to clean it up afterwards. They don't have the luxury of going with renewables. The sheer amount of iron and steel and concrete that would be necessary to build that many windmills, that many solar fields, is just not there.
It sure seems, though, like in this country, the nuclear ship has largely sailed. It just seems like we're going in the opposite direction.
And indeed we are. And I think the answer for this country is probably going to be the next generation of designs, which are much more favorable in many ways to what we want in the form of a energy supply. But China is planning to build 100 nuclear power plants by 2030. And that's just the beginning as far as they're concerned.
All right.
India as well. So that those countries are going to have to go nuclear.
Richard Rhodes, I got to conclude, but thank you so much for talking about your book, Energy, A Human History. From all of us at Air Talk, have a great afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next.